This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
Thank you. Looking at the livestock markets, market analyst for Water Street Solutions, Arlen Suderman, says the largest current factor is the avian influenza outbreak currently affecting Arkansas, Missouri, Minnesota, California, Washington, and Oregon. The outbreak's impacts are being felt by more than just the poultry industry.
When we look at the livestock markets, we rallied on Monday to start the week as the live cattle futures tried to closed the gap somewhat with the cash market. Last week's cash trade was mostly 158 to 160, a few of them down to 156, but the 158 to 160 on a live basis caught the bulk of the trade. And with the February contract going off the board, that left the lead April contract at quite a discount. Rallied up into an area chart congestion, did not have the strength to push through it. So now as we come, it's turnaround Tuesday, traders selling down from that area of chart resistance, and we're seeing weakness return. Same thing in the feeder cattle market with weakness in the fat cattle. There's simply not the enthusiasm at the sale barn to push prices higher. We've got some pretty stiff resistance for the lead March contract at that 205 level, and nothing happening at the sale barn to necessarily prove them wrong in doing that.
The plummeting pork prices do seem to be correcting after the downturn they've experienced thanks to the poultry markets.
Well, we will see a new quarterly hogs and pigs report come out later this month to try to get a handle on just what the scope of the expansion of the hog industry has been over the last several months. But generally, when you look at the numbers, we're slaughtering more hogs than we did a year ago and at heavier weights, and the supply is overwhelming the demand. We did see the poor weather slow the movement of hogs to packing plants, and that allowed the cash market over the last five or six trading days to move higher, and that's been encouraging, but the product market really has not followed through in that trend, and so the product continues overall to be in a downtrend, and that's not bullish long term. We tried to rally the futures market based on that stabilization of the cash market, but the general fear is now that once the weather improves and those hogs go to market, that they'll be at heavier weights, and we'll just add that much more supply to the anemic demand.
While we wait for the quarterly hogs and pigs report, inventory is being taken of the cattle herd. Cattle numbers are down, but that's not the only reason why we're seeing fewer U.S. cattle being slaughtered.
Well, certainly both are enjoying the cheaper corn prices. I know both cattlemen and hogmen would like to see the cheaper corn prices reducing their input costs, and they're certainly glad with these prices, particularly for hogs, that we're not looking at the $6 corn prices. But margin suppression has gone across agriculture now, both for the crop producer and for the livestock producer. We're seeing that margin suppression, and it means they just have to work that much harder at trying to hit singles and doubles in their marketing and their risk management plans.
Again, that was market analyst for Water Street Solutions, Arlen Suderman, giving his insights into this week's grain and livestock markets. The BNSF Railway is almost completely caught up on its railcar backlog from the winter of 2013 through 2014. BNSF Group Vice President of Agricultural Products, John Miller, says they've actually seen their velocity go up this past winter.
Been more consistent and more predictable for customers out there so they can plan their businesses accordingly. And we are running very strong volumes right now, running over 120 shuttles. And we have carved our past dues and our non-shuttles down sharply, much lower than we were a year ago at this time. I can tell you that we were 15,000 past dues in the U.S. a year ago, and this morning we're under 2,000. North Dakota hit as high as much as 8,000 past dues a year ago at this time, and now we're down at 845 cars past due on our non-shuttles in North Dakota. Minnesota has got a total of 94 cars past due, and South Dakota is 185 cars past due. So in the ag world, that's essentially current across the network.
To get more train cars moving in the winter, BNSF did something no other rail company did. They took cars off the tracks. Miller says that it's greatly improved their velocity.
As the velocity has gotten better, it actually kicks out assets. So we are parking across our system now over 500 locomotives, which is an amazing stat. In just a few months, we've turned this from bringing all these locomotives on to all of a sudden we're parking locomotives. That's a function of our increased velocity. So we're moving trains faster than we have. So we don't need as many locomotives to run what we have. And that is creating windows across the network in terms of just flexibility and fluidity. As a result, the same thing happens in cars. That means more windows and just more fluidity, and it's just a virtuous cycle. We've actually offered grain cars in the marketplace for which we have not gotten bids. We're still selling plenty of freight, but we've actually offered more freight than the market needs today, which is a complete change from a year ago.
BNSF has committed to spending almost $6 billion on network improvements this year. Miller says work has begun in their southern areas and will move north as the weather changes to spring and summer. That's all for part one of this afternoon's Farm Show. Stay tuned for part two, coming up after this. Most farms are a family business. Whether small or large, on the East Coast or West Coast, family farms produce food for people all across the U.S. and the world. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service is celebrating the diversity of the American family farmer this National Ag Day by helping answer this question, what is a family farmer? Ginger Harris is a demographer with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service.
Family farms make up almost the entirety of U.S. farms. 97% of the 2.1 million farms in the U.S. are family-owned operations. That is, the majority of the operation is owned by people who are related by blood, marriage, or adoption.
Family farms produce almost all of the food grown in the U.S., according to Harris.
While 97% of all farms in the U.S. are these family-owned operations, they're producing 84% of all the products in the U.S. Most of what we eat, and if we're wearing cotton or wool that's produced in the U.S., that's coming from a family-owned operation.
Harris says 88% of all U.S. farms are relatively small family farms.
What's sold at farmers markets, much of that is coming from small family farms. 58% of all direct farm sales to consumers are coming from small family farms, and those are places with under $350,000 in gross receipts from agricultural income.
Harris says many of the large farms are still family-owned and operated.
A cow may start out on a small family farm and during its life cycle move up to a large family farm where it's sold for meat, but these farms are engaging at every point in the ag economy. Each of these different types of operations may specialize in something different, but they're all important to U.S. agriculture.
NASS relies on family farmers across the country to share information about their operations by responding to official surveys. And thanks to those who have shared their information, the compiled survey results better inform the public about the nature of family farming in the U.S. You can visit agcensus.usda.gov for more information about family farms. Cover crops have been gaining in popularity nationwide for a variety of reasons. Farmers are seeing benefits through decreased soil compaction, decreased soil erosion, improved pest control, and more. But, as with many things in farming, using cover crops doesn't always turn up ideal results. David Moose of Auburn has been growing cover crops for 3 years now in the hopes of improving soil organic matter, with results that might have some farmers deciding to scratch the idea of using cover crops.
I've been satisfied probably one out of the last 3 years. I think establishment has been one of the biggest issues in year two and three, but I'm working through this and I will succeed.
To help combat establishment issues, Moose is hoping to change up the varieties of cover crops he uses.
Yeah, I think I have to adjust my varieties that I'm planting to accommodate a more timely planting of the cover crops. I'd also like to experiment with different species to try to build different organisms in the soil. Presently, I'm using annual rye, cereal rye, crimson clover, tillage radishes. In the future, I'd like to maybe experiment with Austrian winter peas, some hairy vetch, maybe some turnips.
After utilizing cover crops for a few years, Moose says others who are thinking of getting into cover crops need to make sure they are ready to commit to a long-term project on their farm and learn from their experiences year to year.
Well, I would have to say that it's not for the faint of heart. It does take a total commitment, and it's not a year-to-year thing. But just like no-till, I feel like I'm going through the growing pains right now of what that was. But I feel like going forward, I've learned a lot of things that will make me successful.
As for his future with cover crops, Moose says he will continue the practice until he has perfected it, stating he believes it will pay off in the future.
Well, it goes back to that goal that I want to build organic matter and to, you know, prevent erosion. And I think down the line there will be more rules and regulations prohibiting doing certain applications of fertilizer and chemicals. So I'm trying to get ahead of the curve on that.
Again, that was Auburn farmer David Moose speaking about his experience with cover crops. That's all for this afternoon's Farm Show. For WSMI, I'm Angela Besh. Thanks for tuning in.